The edges of the future. How many of us have found ourselves in a borderland as we've considered what kind of work, or indeed if there is a kind of work that calls to us in any given moment, right? Who has not? I don't want to put it that way. I have been in that place. It's such a great description for our work towards equity and justice, the edges of the future, because the edge is where we're the most uncomfortable, poised to move into a future we hope will be more just, but might be challenging to get to, might be hard to do the inner work that has to go with the outer work. I was invited to talk about reparations today. Reparations is one of my edges. But before I can do that, I need to talk a little bit about impact, and specifically today, impact on our Black siblings. Slavery, Jim Crow, and segregation have had impacts on our Black siblings, impacts on their bodies, impacts on their family structures, impacts on their quality of life, impacts on their identities. The society and the culture that have been created in this country have served to teach our white people that have served to teach our white people to believe that they deserve the unlimited possibilities that the great American dream offers. And they have served to teach our Black people that they are not worthy of those same possibilities. Now, of course, that's a broad brushstroke, right? At its worst, our nation seems to believe that the disparities in services and education and healthcare and policing and incarceration for people of color in general and Black people specifically are deserved. And even at our best, I'm afraid, we tend to simply think that those disparities are just the way things are. But they were created. They were created as systems were put into place to benefit white people and are being perpetuated in our names. And so income and potential income for Black folks are tied to all of this. I'm going to draw pretty heavily on Ta-Nehisi Coates' 2014 article called The Case for Reparations, where he traces a pattern of financial impacts to Black people throughout the history of our nation. So first is slavery itself, right? The unpaid nature of that hard manual labor moved the money that would have gone to workers to the plantation and the business owners instead. And the slaves themselves, the human beings, were commodities who were bought and sold to bring profits to owners. Second was the withholding of financial resources and assistance to Blacks during segregation and during Jim Crow, both in the North and the South. Coates writes, "Social Security and unemployment insurance excluded farm workers and domestics, jobs heavily occupied by Blacks. The oft-celebrated GI Bill similarly failed Black Americans by mirroring the broader country's insistence on a racist housing policy." And it was the Homeowners Loan Corporation, not a private trade association, that pioneered the practice of redlining, selectively granting loans and insisting that any property it insured be covered by a restrictive covenant, a clause in the deed forbidding the sale of the property to anyone other than whites. Millions of dollars flowed from tax coffers into segregated white neighborhoods. Coates argues all of these programs that were offered preferentially to whites made it so that Blacks had to pay more for the basic necessities than whites did, which served then to create and then to widen those racial disparities we see today. So in his words, the federal government is premised on equal fealty to all its citizens, who in return are to receive equal treatment. But as late as the mid-20th century, this bargain was not granted to Black people, who repeatedly paid a higher price for citizenship and received less in return. Plunder, he writes, had been the essential feature of slavery, but practically a full century after the end of the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, the plunder, quiet, systemic, submerged, continued, even amidst the dreams and achievements of New Deal liberals. Our Unitarian Universalist history echoes our national history. During slave times, many of our Unitarian ancestors worked toward abolition, though there was debate about them whether it should be immediate or a gradual end that would allow the industries that slavery supported time to find alternatives to the free labor and subsequent huge profits. And many of our northern Unitarian ancestors had financial investments that were directly tied to slave labor and did not support the abolitionist movement. And many of them who didn't benefit directly from slavery and were willing to engage it as a moral and religious issue were not willing to engage it as a political issue. So they acknowledged the immorality of slavery, but they respected law and order and feared the risk to the nation's unity. In 1850, President Willard Fillmore signed the Fugitive Slave Act, which required the return of fugitive slaves to their masters in the South and required private citizens in the North to assist in their capture. Fillmore, in case you didn't know, was a Unitarian. Later in the 19th century and into the 20th, many of the black men, because mostly it was men in those days, who wanted to enter the Unitarian ministry were either passively or actively discouraged by the American Unitarian Association or by the seminaries themselves. And those who had the tenacity to pursue those divinity degrees found themselves either getting little help in finding or starting churches or again being actively blocked from doing so. And then in the 1960s, the black empowerment controversy happened. In the midst of the civil rights era, black Unitarian Universalists were also trying to find ways to have their needs met. A black affairs council was formed in an emergency conference in 1967 in response to the national racial unrest and rioting to promote black self-determination, and the association promised $250,000 in funding per year for 4 years. The next year, a group of black and white UUs formed a pro-integration group called the Black and White Alternative. And that year's General Assembly, which is where we gather to do our business, voted to approve the funding for the Black Affairs Council, the all-black group. This was considered a move toward reparations in that racially tense environment of the late 1960s. But then the UUA Association's Board of Trustees learned that an endowment fund that they thought they had money in, they did not. And so the funds were not available. And there was a recommendation to the 1969 General Assembly to keep the promise of funding, but to make sure that they voted every year to reaffirm that $250,000, which sounded to some people like a possibility that money might not come. They also voted that year to fund the Black and White Alternative. So they withdrew, they didn't actively withdraw, but they withdrew the possibility of the funding for the Black Affairs Council, but did fund the Black and White Alternative. So there were some pretty strong opinions about this on the General Assembly floor. And amidst tears and shouting, 400 people, most of the black delegates and many of their white allies, walked out. They were persuaded to return, and that first year's $250,000 to the Black Affairs Council was affirmed by vote. And the Black and White Alternative, it turns out, was not funded. But then over the next few years, the structure of funding was changed, so they didn't quite honor the promise. They backed it off to $200,000 a year for 5 years and still needed to vote on it every year. And it didn't all come through. And the Black Affairs Council disaffiliated themselves from the association so they could seek funding outside our structure. It's estimated that about 1,000 black people left our faith in the wake of this disappointment. Imagine, in the sea of 3,000 to 5,000 people that attend our General Assemblies, having 1,000 black people among them. I can't picture that. What could it have been like to have had the inspiration and the voices of so many black people as the evolution of our faith continued? What might Unitarian Universalism look like, or sound like, or feel like if those people had stayed, if they had gotten what they needed and stayed? This is where the possibilities that reparations can offer start to come in. Coates advocates for a study on the possibility of reparations, which has actually been proposed, I didn't know this, this has actually been proposed to Congress as H.R. 40 by Representative John Conyers Jr. of Michigan every year from 1989 to 2017. But Coates writes about the obstacles to this. Perhaps after a serious discussion and debate, the kind that H.R. 40 proposes, we may find that the country can never fully repay African Americans. But we stand to discover much about ourselves in such a discussion, he writes, and that is perhaps what scares us. The idea of reparations is frightening, not simply because we might lack the ability to pay. The idea of reparations threatens something much deeper: Americans' heritage, history, and standing in the world. And so we must imagine a new country. Reparations, by which I mean the full acceptance of our collective biography and its consequences, is the price we must pay to see ourselves squarely. Reparations beckon us to reject the hubris and see America as it is, the work of fallible humans. This conversation, the beginnings of acceptance of our collective biography and its consequences, is happening in small pockets, even though it hasn't gotten into Congress. Like so many other social contracts and networks that I have seen form in lieu of the protections that are slowly being withdrawn from certain groups of people in our nation today, there are mechanisms for reparations cropping up in our society. Dallas Robinson, a young black farmer in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, recently received an email from a stranger offering her a large sum of money to help establish the Harriet Tubman Freedom Farm, which is in a location where the poverty rate is near 20% and food insecurity and obesity rates are even higher. The gift was facilitated by the creation and publication of a new interactive online map called the Black Indigenous Farmers Reparations Map, which shows locations and information of black and indigenous-owned farms who need financial support. The map was created by Leah Penniman of Soul Fire Farm in Chicago. Kate Poole, a young white woman, has created an organization called Regenerative Finance, which is made of young people who have access to wealth and a desire to put that wealth back into places that have long experienced exploitation. One of their projects has been to raise a large loan for a fledgling grocery store in a food desert in an African-American neighborhood in Greensboro, North Carolina. The interest from the loan will go directly into the Southern Reparations Loan Fund to be reinvested in similar projects. Here in Madison, last February, the Associated Students of Madison and some of their representatives introduced campus legislation calling for test optional admissions and reparations in the full and free access for all black people to attend UW-Madison. The legislation would effectively make tuition free for all black people, undocumented students, and formerly incarcerated students. Unfortunately, I didn't see any news articles after February 16th, 2017, so I don't know what's going on there. And it's happening in our faith tradition. This month, as we consider what it means to be a people of balance, one of the things we're doing is trying to balance our congregation's budget for the next year. And many of us, myself included, in the context of deciding what we're planning to pledge to REEB, are also deciding what other organizations and work we will support financially, right? Because it's all a balance. We offered a worship service recently called The Promise and the Practice, in which we lifted up voices of color in our faith tradition and shared some of their experiences of marginalization or diminishment in our congregation, in our congregations and in other gatherings. The Promise and the Practice of Our Faith is a campaign aimed at intentionally repairing damage done to Black Unitarian Universalists by discrimination and by the Black empowerment controversy. I encourage you to take a look at the insert in your order of service and fill out the pledge form, if you choose. Knowing that our board has endorsed contributing to this campaign as a congregation, and that if our collective pledge averages out to $10 per member or more, it will be matched. This is the work of reparations happening in our own faith tradition, and the power of admitting as an institution that this work is necessary blows me away. The knowledge that Black UUs are coming back to Unitarian Universalism because they're learning to believe that this faith can once again be a saving faith for them fills me with hope for all of our healing. For our Black siblings to be acknowledged for the gifts of faith that they are. For other siblings of color who have been diminished by different versions of this story and by our culture that was built to favor white folks over others. And for my white siblings and for myself, who might learn to feel the satisfaction and the joy of being called to be part of a process to rebuild trust and to widen the ranges of experience we can all have in this faith. And as Karen said in her testimonial, to learn about giving as a spiritual practice. There are also calls for person-to-person giving currently happening in Unitarian Universalism. I have witnessed several asks for funding of UUs of color to create startup ministries or to support themselves or their families while they seek education or professional development to apply to our faith tradition, to do the work of our faith tradition. If that is something that interests you, talk to me after the service. This is where I think Unitarian Universalism can meet the call toward reparations. I don't know enough to be able to argue definitively that we should advocate for reparations on a national scale. I don't. I need to read way more, and I need to learn more, and I need to talk more. And there are a few things that jump out at me. First, because I know our history, and because I'm eager to see how our faith tradition can become even stronger and richer in spirit than it is now, I can most certainly advocate for the reparations that the Promise and Practice campaign embodies. I'm invested in that. And in that vein, I do invite you to look at that insert in your order of service. Second, I can say that as a covenantal faith that encourages us to come into conversation with each other and with our companion congregations when we face things that inspire us or that challenge us, things that put us on that edge of the future, I think we have a lot to offer in wider conversations about hard issues like this. If Ta-Nehisi Coates thinks that it's the conversation that we're afraid of, we know how to do that. I think we as UUs can add to those conversations about the possibilities that reparations can offer, and so we need to learn about them. And that we can help them be open and positive conversations that can help us all heal and grow. And third, I think we're primed to consider participating in reparations ourselves. We've learned to think of the stewardship of our congregation as giving of our time and treasure and talent in order to keep our congregation strong and healthy and make our work in the world possible. And as a congregation, we're also thinking of the health of our community when we offer our time and talents to the work of creating peace, justice, and sustainability. We do that work in our community. We're learning the spiritual benefits of being healed through solidarity and through collective liberation and the spiritual practice of giving. So I want to invite us to consider balancing on the edge of a possible future in which we also offer our treasure to help repair the wounds of quiet, systemic, and submerged plunder. May it be so. May we be so.